the sale and had rushed around during their lunch break, running in to get some items and running out again, so that they did not have time in the middle of all the crush to see where she was and say hello. Mrs. Kehoe seemed pleased by the pair of stockings and offered to pay for them, but Eilish said they were a gift. That evening, during supper, they all talked about Bartocci's famous nylon sale, which always happened without warning, yet they were amazed when Eilish told them that even she who worked there had no idea the sale was going to happen. "Well, if you ever hear even a rumor," Diana said, "you'll have to let us all know. And the nylon stockings are the best. They don't run as easily as some of the others. They'd sell you garbage, some of those other stores."
"That's enough now," Mrs. Kehoe said. "I'm sure all the stores are doing their best."
With all the excitement and discussion surrounding the nylon sale, Eilish did not notice until the end of the meal that there were three letters for her. The minute she came back from work every day, she had checked the side table in the kitchen where Mrs. Kehoe left letters. She could not believe that she had forgotten to check this evening. She drank a cup of tea with the others, holding the letters in her hand nervously, feeling her heart beating faster when she thought about them, waiting to go to her room and open them and read the news from home. The letters, she knew by the handwriting, were from her mother and Rose and Jack. She decided to read her mother's first and leave Rose's until the end. Her mother's letter was short, and there was no news in it, just a list of the people who were asking for her, with some details of where her mother had met them and when. Jack's letter was much the same, but with references to the crossing that she had told him about in her letter, and had said very little about in her letter to her mother and Rose. Rose's handwriting was, she saw, very beautiful and clear, as usual. She wrote about golf and work, and how quiet and dull the town was, and how lucky Eilish was to be in the bright lights. In a postscript, she suggested that Eilish might like sometimes to write to her separately about private matters or things that might worry their mother too much. She suggested that Eilish might use her work address for these letters. The letters told Eilish little. There was hardly anything personal in them, and nothing that sounded like anyone's own voice. Nonetheless, as she read them over and over, she forgot for a moment where she was, and she could picture her mother in the kitchen taking her Basildon Bond notepad and her envelopes and setting out to write a proper letter with nothing crossed out. Rose, she thought, might have gone into the dining room to write on paper she had taken home from work, using a longer, more elegant white envelope than her mother had. Eilish imagined that Rose, when she was finished, might have left hers on the hall table, and her mother would have gone with both letters in the morning to the post office, having to get special stamps for America. She could not imagine where Jack had written his letter, which was briefer than the other two, almost shy in its tone, as though he did not want to put too much in writing. She lay on the bed with the letters beside her. For the past few weeks, she realized, she had not really thought of home. The town had come to her in flashing pictures, such as the one that had come during the afternoon of the sale, and she had thought, of course, of her mother and Rose. But her own life in Enniscorthy, the life she had lost and would never have again, she had kept out of her mind. Every day she had come back to this small room in this house full of sounds and gone over everything new that had happened. Now all that seemed like nothing compared to the picture she had of home, of her own room, the house in Frary Street, the food she had eaten there, the clothes she wore, how quiet everything was. All this came to her like a terrible weight, and she felt for a second that she was going to cry. It was as though an ache in her chest was trying to force tears down her cheeks, despite her enormous effort to keep them back. She did not give in to whatever it was. She kept thinking, attempting to work out what was causing this new feeling that was like despondency, that was like how she felt when her father died and she watched them closing the coffin, the feeling that he would never see the world again and she would never be able to talk to him again. She was nobody here. It was not just that she had no friends and family, it was rather that she was a ghost in this room, in the streets on the way to work, on the shop floor. Nothing meant anything. The rooms in the house on Frary Street belonged to her, she thought. When she moved in them, she was really there. In the town, if she walked to the shop or the vocational school, the air, the light, the ground, it was all solid and part of her, even if she met no one familiar. Nothing here was part of her. It was false, empty, she thought.
She closed her eyes and tried to think, as she had done so many times in her life, of something she was looking forward to. But there was nothing. Not the slightest thing, not even Sunday. Nothing maybe except sleep, and she was not even certain she was looking forward to sleep. In any case, she could not sleep yet, since it was not yet 9 o'clock. There was nothing she could do. It was as though she had been locked away. In the morning, she was not sure that she had slept so much as lived a set of vivid dreams, letting them linger so that she would not have to open her eyes and see the room. One of the dreams was about the courthouse at the top of Frary Hill in Enniscorthy. She remembered now how much the neighbors had dreaded the day when the court sat, not because of the cases that were reported in the papers of petty theft or drunkenness or disorderly behavior, but because sometimes the court ordered children to be taken into care, put into orphanages or industrial schools or foster homes because they mitched from school or caused trouble or because of problems with their parents. Sometimes inconsolable mothers could be found screaming, howling outside the courthouse as their children were taken away. But her dream had no screaming women, just a group of silent children, Eilish among them, standing in a line, knowing that they would soon be led away on the orders of the judge. What was strange for her now as she lay awake was that she had seemed to be looking forward to being led away. She had felt no fear of it. Her fear, instead, was of seeing her mother in front of the courthouse. In her dream, she found a way of avoiding her mother. She was taken out of the line and through a side door and then on a car journey that appeared to last as long as she could stay asleep. She got up and used the bathroom very quietly. She thought that she would have breakfast in one of the diners on Fulton Street, as she had seen people do on her way to work. Once she was dressed and ready, she tiptoed out of the house. She did not want to meet any of the others. It was only 7:30. She would, she thought, sit somewhere for an hour, having a coffee and a sandwich, and then go to work early. As she walked, she began to dread the day. Later, as she sat at the counter of a diner looking at a menu, snatches of another dream that she had only half remembered when she woke came to her. She was flying, as though in a balloon, over the calm sea on a calm day. Below, she could see the cliffs at Cush Gap and the soft sand at Ballyconiger. The wind was propelling her towards Blackwater, then the Bala, then Monaghan, then Vinegar Hill and Enniscorthy. She was lost so much in the memory of this dream that the waiter behind the counter asked her if she was all right. "I'm fine," she said.
"You look sad," he replied.
She shook her hair and tried to smile and ordered a coffee and a sandwich.
"Cheer up," he said in a louder voice. "Come on, cheer up. It'll never happen. Give us a smile."
A few of the other customers at the counter looked at her. She knew that she would not be able to hold back the tears. She did not wait for her order to arrive, but ran out of the diner before anyone could say anything else to her. During the day, she felt that Miss Fortini was looking at her more than usual, and this made her acutely conscious of how she appeared when she was not dealing directly with a customer. She tried to look towards the door and the front windows and the street. She tried to seem busy, but she found that she could, if she did not stop herself, move easily into a sort of trance, thinking over and over of the same things, about everything she had lost, and wondering how she would face going back to the evening meal with the others and the long night alone in a room that had nothing to do with her. Then she would find Miss Fortini staring at her across the shop floor, and she would try once again to seem cheerful and helpful to customers, as though it were a normal day at work. The evening meal was not as difficult as she had imagined, as both Patty and Diana had bought new shoes, and Mrs. Kehoe, before she could give them her full approval, needed to see what costume or dress and other accessories they would be worn with. The kitchen before and after supper became like a fashion parade, with both Miss McAdam and Miss Keegan withholding approval each time Patty or Diana came into the room wearing the shoes and some new set of clothes with a different handbag. Mrs. Kehoe was not sure, once she had seen Diana's shoes with the costume they were intended to match, that they were dressy enough. "They are neither fish nor fowl," she said. "You couldn't wear them to work, and they mightn't look great on a night out somewhere. I can't see why you bought them unless there was a sale."
Diana looked crestfallen as she admitted that there had been no sale.
"Oh, then," Mrs. Kehoe said,
"all I can say is that I hope you kept the receipt."
"Well, I quite like them," Miss McAdam said.
So do I,
Sheila Heffernan added. But when would you wear them? Mrs. Kehoe asked.
I just like them, Miss McAdam said and shrugged.
Eilish slipped away, glad no one had noticed that she had not spoken once at the meal. She wondered if she could go out now, do anything rather than face her tomb of a bedroom and all the thoughts that would come when she lay awake, and all the dreams that would come when she slept. She stood in the hall, and then turned upstairs, realizing that she was afraid, too, of the outside, and even if she were not, she would have no idea where to go at this time of the evening. She hated this house, she thought. Its smells, its noises, its colors. She was already crying as she went up the stairs. She knew that as long as the others were discussing their wardrobes in the kitchen below, she would be able to cry as loudly as she pleased without their hearing her. That night was the worst she had ever spent. It was only as the dawn came that she remembered something Jack had said to her on the day in Liverpool before she had caught the boat, a time that now seemed like years ago. He had said that he found being away hard at first, but he did not elaborate, and she did not think of asking him what it really had been like. His manner was so mild and good-humored, just as her father's had been, that he would not in any case want to complain. She considered writing to him now, asking him if he too had felt like this, as though he had been shut away somewhere and was trapped in a place where there was nothing. It was like hell, she thought, because she could see no end to it, and to the feeling that came with it. But the torment was strange. It was all in her mind. It was like the arrival of night if you knew that you would never see anything in daylight again. She did not know what she was going to do, but she knew that Jack was too far away to be able to help her. None of them could help her. She had lost all of them. They would not find out about this. She would not put it into a letter. And because of this, she understood that they would never know her now. Maybe, she thought, they had never known her, any of them, because if they had, then they would have had to realize what this would be like for her. She lay there as the light of day began. She did not think she would be able to manage another night like this. For a while, she was quietly resigned to the prospect that nothing would change, but she did not know what the consequences would be or what form they would take. Once more, she got up early and left the house without making a sound, and walked the streets for an hour before going to have a cup of coffee. She noticed the cold in the air for the first time. It seemed to her that the weather had changed, but it hardly mattered now what the weather was like. She found a place in a diner where she could have her back to everybody, and no one could comment on the expression on her face. By the time she drank the coffee and had a bun and managed to get the waitress's attention to pay the bill, she realized that she had left herself too short a time to get to work. If she did not hurry, she was going to be late for the first time. There were crowds in the streets, and she could not easily get past people. She wondered at one point if people were not deliberately blocking her way. It took a long time for the traffic lights to change. Once she was on Fulton Street, it was even harder. It was as though crowds were coming out of a football game. Even moving at a normal pace was hard. She arrived at Bartocci's with just a minute to spare. She did not know how she was going to spend the day standing on the shop floor trying to look pleasant and attentive. The minute she appeared upstairs in her work clothes, she caught Miss Fortini's gaze, which seemed disapproving as she began to move towards her, only for her then to be distracted by a customer. Once the customer had been dealt with, Eilish was careful not to look Miss Fortini's way again. She kept her back to her for as long as she could.
"You don't look well," Miss Fortini said when she approached.
Eilish could feel her eyes filling with tears.
"Why don't you go downstairs and have a glass of water, and I'll be down in a second," Miss Fortini said.
Her voice sounded kind, but she did not smile. Eilish nodded. It struck her that she had not yet been paid. She was still living on the money Rose had given her. If they sacked her, she did not know if they would pay her. If they did not, within a short time she would have no money at all. It would be hard, she thought, to find another job, but even if she did, she would have to be paid at the end of the first week, otherwise she would not be able to pay the rent to Mrs. Kehoe. Downstairs, she went into the bathroom and washed her face. She stared at herself in the mirror for a moment, and then stood tidying her hair. Then, in the staff room, she waited for Miss Fortini.
"Now you'll have to tell me what's wrong," she said as she came into the room and closed the door behind her. "Because I can see that there's something wrong, and soon some of the customers will begin to notice, and then we'll all be in trouble.
Eilish shook her head. I don't know what's wrong.
Is it your time of the month? Miss Fortini asked.
Eilish shook her head again.
Eilish.
She pronounced the name strangely, with too much emphasis on the second syllable.
Why are you upset?
She stood in front of her and waited.
Would you like me to call Miss Bartocci? She asked.
No.
Then what?
I don't know what it is.
Are you sad?
Yes.
All the time?
Yes.
Do you wish you were with your family at home?
Yes.
Do you have family here?
No.
No one?
No one.
When did the sadness begin? You were happy last week.
I got some letters.
Bad news?
No, no, nothing.
Just the letters. Have you been out of Ireland before?
No.
Away from your father and mother?
My father is dead.
Your mother?
I've never been away from her before.
Miss Fortini looked at her but did not smile. I'll need to talk to Miss Bartocci and the priest you came with.
Please don't.
They won't cause a problem, but you cannot work here if you're sad. And of course you're sad if you're not with your mother for the first time in your life. But the sadness won't last, so we'll do what we can for you.
Miss Fortini told her to sit down and filled her another glass of water and left the room. It was clear to Eilish as she waited there that she was not going to be sacked. As a result, she was almost proud of how she had managed Miss Fortini, letting her ask all the questions and answering as little as she could, but enough not to seem surly or ungrateful. She felt almost strong as she contemplated what had just happened, and she resolved that no matter who came into the room now, even if it were Mr. Bartocci himself, she would be able to elicit their sympathy. It was not as though there was nothing wrong. Whatever darkness she had felt had not lifted. But she could not tell them that she dreaded their shop and their customers, and that she hated Mrs. Kehoe's house, and there was nothing any of them could do for her. Yet she would have to keep her job, and she believed she had achieved that much, and it gave her a feeling of satisfaction that appeared to melt into her sadness, or float on its surface, distracting her, at least for now, from the worst parts of it. After a while, Miss Fortini arrived with a sandwich that she had brought from a diner near the store. She said that she had spoken to Miss Bartocci and assured her that it was a simple problem, that it had never happened before and might never happen again. But Miss Bartocci had then spoken to her father, who was a special friend of Father Flood, and he had telephoned the priest and left a message with his housekeeper. Mr. Bartocci says you are to stay down here until he hears from Father Flood, and he told me to get you this sandwich. You are one lucky girl. He is sometimes nice the first time like this, but I wouldn't cross him twice. No one crosses Mr. Bartocci twice. I didn't cross him, Eilish said quietly.
Oh, you did, dear. Turning up in that state to work and having that look on your face, oh, you crossed Mr. Bartocci, and it's something that he'll never forget.
As the day went on, some of the other salesgirls from the floor came down to see Eilish, studying her with curiosity, some asking if she was all right, others pretending to search for something in their lockers. As she sat there, she realized that, unless she wanted to lose her job, she would have to make a decision to lift herself out of whatever it was that was affecting her. Miss Fortini did not reappear, but at around 4, Father Flood opened the door.
I hear there's trouble, he said.
She tried to smile.
It's all my fault, he said. They said you were doing great here, and Mrs. Kehoe says you're the nicest girl she's ever had staying, and so I thought you don't want me coming around checking up on you.
I was all right until I got the letters from home, Eilish said.
Do you know what's wrong with you?
Father Flood asked. What do you mean?
There's a name for it.
For what? She thought that he was going to mention some private female complaint. You're homesick, that's all. Everybody gets it. But it passes. In some, it passes more quickly than in others. There's nothing harder than it. And the rule is to have someone to talk to and to keep busy.
I am busy.
Eilish, I hope you don't mind if I try and enroll you in a night class. Do you remember we mentioned bookkeeping and accountancy? It would be 2 or 3 nights a week, but it would keep you busy, and you could get a very good qualification.
Is it not too late to enroll for this year? Some of the girls said that you have to apply in the spring.
It's a funny place, Brooklyn, Father Flood said.
As long as the guy in charge is not Norwegian, and in a college that's unlikely, then I can pull strings most places. The Jews are the best. They always love doing something for you. Say a prayer, it's a Jewish fellow who believes in the power of the collar. We'll try the best college first, and that's Brooklyn College. I love breaking all the rules. So I'll go down there now, and Franco says you are to go home, but be here on time in the morning with a big smile. And I'll drop by Ma Kehoe's later. Eilish almost laughed out loud when he said Ma Kehoe. His accent was, for the first time, pure Enniscorthy. She understood that Franco was Mr. Bartocci, and she was interested in the familiar way in which Father Flood had described him. As soon as he left, she found her coat and slipped quietly out of the shop. She was sure that Miss Fortini had seen her pass, but she did not turn as she made her way quickly along Fulton Street and then home towards Mrs. Kehoe's. As she let herself into the hall with her own key, she found Mrs. Kehoe waiting for her.
"You go into the sitting room there now," Mrs. Kehoe said. "I'm going to make tea for the two of us."
The sitting room, which gave on to the front of the house, was surprisingly beautiful, with old rugs and heavy, comfortable-looking furniture and some dark pictures in gold frames. Double doors opened into a bedroom, and, since one of the doors was open, Eilish could see that the bedroom was decorated in the same heavy, rich style. She looked at the old round dining table and supposed that that was where the game of poker was played on Sunday nights. Her mother, she thought, would love this room. She saw an old gramophone and a wireless in another corner and noticed that the tassels on the tablecloth and the curtains seemed to match. She began to take note of all the details, thinking, for the first time in days, how she could include an account of them in a letter to her mother and Rose. She would write it as soon as she got to her room after supper, she thought, and she would put nothing in about how she had spent the last 2 days. She would try to put those 2 days behind her. No matter what she dreamed about, no matter how bad she felt, she had no choice, she knew, but to put it all swiftly out of her mind. She would have to get on with her work if it was during the day, and go back to sleep if it was during the night. It would be like covering a table with a tablecloth, or closing curtains on a window, and maybe the need would lessen as time went on, as Jack hinted it would, as Father Flood had suggested. In any case, that was what she would have to do. As soon as Mrs. Kehoe appeared with tea things on a tray, Eilish clenched her fist when she felt that she was ready to begin. After the evening meal, Father Flood came, and Eilish was summoned once more into Mrs. Kehoe's private quarters. Father Flood was smiling and went towards the fireplace as soon as Eilish appeared, as if to warm his hands, even though there was no fire lit. He rubbed his hands together and turned towards her. "Now I'll leave the two of you in peace," Mrs. Kehoe said. "If you need me, I'm in the kitchen."
"The power of the Holy Roman and Apostolic Church is not to be underestimated," Father Flood said. "The first thing I found was a nice, devout Italian secretary who told me what courses are full and what courses are really full, and most important, told me what not to ask for. I told her the whole story. I had her in tears."
"I'm glad you think it's funny," Eilish said.
"Oh, cheer up. I got you into the night class in bookkeeping and preliminary accountancy. I told them how brilliant you were. You're the first Irish girl. It's full of Jews and Russians and those Norwegians I told you about, and they'd like to have even more Italians, but they're too busy making money. The Jewish fellow who runs the place looked like he'd never saw a priest in his life before. He stood to attention when he saw me like it was the army. Brooklyn College, only the best. I paid your tuition for the first semester. It's Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, 7 to 10, and Thursday, 7 to 9. If you do it for 2 years and pass all their tests, there's no office in New York won't want you."
"Will I have time?" she asked.
"Of course you will. And start next Monday. I'll get you the books. I have a list here. And you can spend your spare time studying them."
His good humor seemed strange to her. It seemed he was putting on a show. She tried to smile.
"Are you sure this is okay?"
"It's done."
"Did Rose ask you to do this? Is that why you're doing it?"
"I'm doing it for the Lord," he said.
"Tell me really why you're doing it."
He looked at her carefully and left silence for a moment. She returned his gaze calmly, making clear that she wanted a reply.
I was amazed that someone like you would not have a good job in Ireland. When your sister mentioned that you had no work in Ireland, then I said I would help you to come here. That's all. And we need Irish girls in Brooklyn.
Would any Irish girl do?
Eilish asked. Don't be sour. You asked me why I was doing it.
I'm very grateful to you, Eilish said. She had used a tone that she had heard her mother use, which was very dry and formal. She knew that Father Flood could not tell whether she meant what she said or not.
You'll make a great accountant, he said, but a bookkeeper first. And no more tears? Is that a deal?
No more tears, she said quietly.
When she came back from work the following evening, he had left a pile of books for her, as well as ledgers and copybooks and a set of pens. He had also arranged with Mrs. Kehoe that she could take a packed meal with her the first 3 days of each week at no extra charge.
Now it will just be ham or a slice of tongue and some salad and brown bread. You'll have to get tea somewhere along the way, Mrs. Kehoe said.
And I told Father Flood that since I would already be getting my reward in heaven, I have that nicely arranged, thank you, he owes me a favor that I would like repaid on this earth, and before too long. You know, it's about time someone spoke up to him.
He's very nice, Eilish said.
He's nice to those he's nice to, Mrs. Kehoe said. But I hate a priest rubbing his hands together and smiling. You see that a lot with the Italian priests, and I don't like it. I wish he was more dignified. That's all I have to say about him.
Some of the books were simple. One or two appeared so basic that she wondered if they could be used in a college at all. But the first chapter that she read in the book on commercial law was all new to her, and she could not see how it might apply to bookkeeping. She found it difficult, with many references to judgments of the courts. She hoped that this would not be an important part of the course. Slowly, she became used to the timetable at Brooklyn College, the 3-hour sessions with 10-minute breaks, the strange way in which everything was explained from first principles, including the simple matter of writing down in an ordinary ledger all the money going into the bank and all the money going out, and the date and the name of the person making the deposit or making the withdrawal or writing the check. This was easy, as were the types of accounts you could have in a bank and the different sorts of interest rates. But when it came to drawing up annual accounts, the system was different from the system she had learned, with many more factors added in, and many more complex features, including city, state, and federal taxes. She wished she could tell the difference between Jews and Italians. Some of the Jews wore skull caps, and many more of them appeared to wear glasses than did the Italians. But most of the students were dark-skinned with brown eyes, and most were diligent and serious-looking young men. There were very few women in her class, and no one Irish at all, no one even English. They all seemed to know each other, and they moved in groups, but they were polite to her, careful to make space for her and to make her feel at ease without anyone offering to see her home. No one asked her any questions about herself, or sat beside her more than once. The classes were much larger than the classes she had attended at home, and she wondered if this was why the instructors went so slowly. The law instructor, who took the class after the break on Wednesdays, was clearly Jewish. She thought the name Rosenblum was Jewish, but he also made jokes about being Jewish and spoke in a foreign accent that she guessed was not Italian. He talked big, asking them all the time to imagine that they were the president of a large corporation, larger than that owned by Henry Ford, being sued by another corporation or by the federal government. He then drew their attention to real cases in which the issues he had outlined were actually argued. He knew the names of the lawyers who had done the arguing, and the track records and the temperaments of the judges who decided the cases, and the further judges of the appeal courts. Eilish had no trouble understanding Mr. Rosenblum's accent, and even when he made mistakes in grammar or syntax or used the wrong word, she could follow him. Like the other students, she took notes when he spoke, but she could find nothing in her book on basic commercial law about most of the cases he mentioned. When she wrote home about Brooklyn College, she tried to describe to her mother and Rose some of the jokes Mr. Rosenblum made, in which there was always a Pole and an Italian. It was easier to describe the atmosphere he created, how much the students looked forward to Wednesdays after the break, and how easy and exciting he made corporate litigation sound. But she worried about the exam questions that Mr. Rosenblum would set. One day after class,
She asked one of her fellow students, a young man with glasses and curly hair and a friendly yet studious appearance.
"Maybe we'd better ask him what book he's reading from," the young man said and looked worried for a moment.
"I don't think he's reading from a book,"
Eilish said. "Are you British?"
"No, Irish."
"Oh, Irish," he said, and nodded and smiled. "Well, see you next week. Maybe we can ask him then."
The weather grew cold, and sometimes in the morning it was icy when the wind blew. She had read her law book twice and had taken notes on it and bought a second book that Mr. Rosenblum had recommended, and it lay on her bedside table close to the alarm clock, which rang each morning at 7:55, just as Sheila Heffernan was starting her shower in the bathroom across the landing. What she loved most about America, Eilish thought on these mornings, was how the heating was kept on all night. She wrote to her mother and Rose and to Jack and the boys about it. "The air was like toast," she said, "even on winter mornings, and you had no fear when getting out of bed that your feet were going to freeze on the floor. And if you woke in the night with the wind howling outside, you could turn over happily in your warm bed." Her mother wrote back wondering how Mrs. Kehoe could afford to keep the heating on all night, and Eilish replied to say that it was not just Mrs. Kehoe, who was not in any way extravagant. It was everyone in America. They all kept their heating on all night. As she began to buy Christmas presents to send to her mother and Rose and Jack, Pat and Martin, checking how early she would have to post them so that they would arrive on time, she pondered on what Christmas Day would be like at Mrs. Kehoe's kitchen table. She wondered if each of the lodgers would exchange presents. In late November, she received a formal letter from Father Flood asking her if she would, as a special favor to him, work in the parish hall on Christmas Day, serving dinners to people who did not have anywhere else to go. He knew, he said, that it would be a great sacrifice for her to make. She wrote back immediately to let him know that, as long as she was not working, she would be available during the Christmas period, including Christmas Day, any time he needed her. She let Mrs. Kehoe know that she would not be spending Christmas in the house, but working for Father Flood.
"Well, I wish you would take a few of the others with you," Mrs. Kehoe said. "I won't name them or anything, but it's the one day of the year I like a bit of peace. Indeed, I might end up presenting myself to you and Father Flood as a person in need, just to get a bit of peace."
"I'm sure you would be very welcome, Mrs. Kehoe,"
Eilish said, and then, having realized how offensive that remark might sound, added quickly, as Mrs. Kehoe glared at her, "But of course you'll be needed here, and it's nice to be in your own house for Christmas."
"I dread it, to be honest," Mrs. Kehoe said, "and if it wasn't for my religious convictions, I'd ignore it like the Jews do. In parts of Brooklyn, it could be any day of the week. I always think that's why you get a biting cold on Christmas Day, to remind you. And we'll miss you now for the dinner. I was looking forward to having a Wexford face."
One day, as she was walking to work, crossing State Street, Eilish saw a man selling watches. She was early for work and so had time to linger at his stand. She knew nothing about types of watches, but thought the prices were very low. She had enough money in her handbag to buy one for each of her brothers. Even if they already had watches, and she knew that Martin wore her father's watch, these could serve them if the old ones broke or had to be repaired, and they were from America, which might mean something in Birmingham, and they would be easy to package and cheap to send. In Lohman's, one lunchtime, she found beautiful Angora wool cardigans that cost more than she had in mind, but she came back the next day and bought one for her mother and one for Rose, and wrapped them together with a nylon stocking she had bought on the sale and sent them to Ireland. Slowly, Christmas decorations began to appear in the stores and streets of Brooklyn. After supper one Friday evening, when Mrs. Kehoe had left the kitchen, Miss McAdam wondered when Mrs. Kehoe would put up the decorations.
"Last year she waited until the last minute, and that took all the good out of it," Miss McAdam said.
Patty and Diana were going to stay near Central Park, they said, with Patty's sister and her children and have a real Christmas, with presents and visits to Santa Claus. Miss Keegan said that it was not really Christmas if you were not in your own house in Ireland, and she was going to be sad all day, and there was no point in pretending that she wouldn't be.
"Do you know something?" Sheila Heffernan interjected. "There's no taste off American turkeys. Even the one we had at Thanksgiving tasted of nothing except sawdust.
It isn't Mrs. Kehoe's fault. It's the same all over America.
All over America? Diana asked. In every part? She and Patty began to laugh.
It'll be quiet anyway, Sheila said pointedly, glancing in their direction. We won't have so much useless chatter.
Oh, I wouldn't bet on that, Patty said. We might come down the chimney to fill your stocking when you're least expecting us, Sheila.
Patty and Diana both laughed again. Eilish did not tell any of them what she was doing for Christmas. At breakfast one day the following week, however, it was clear that Mrs. Kehoe had told them.
Oh, God, Sheila said. They take in every old fellow off the street. You'd never know what they'd have.
I heard about it all right, Miss Keegan said. They put funny hats on the down-and-outs and give them bottles of stout.
You're a saint, Eilish, Patty said. A living saint.
At work, Miss Fortini asked Eilish if she would stay on late in the evenings in the week before Christmas, and she agreed, as the college had closed for a 2 weeks' holiday. She also agreed to work Christmas Eve up to the very last minute, since some of the other girls on the floor wanted to leave early to catch trains and buses and be with their families. When she finished at Bartocci's on Christmas Eve, she went directly, as arranged, to the parish hall, so that she could take instructions for the next day. Long tables were being carried in from a truck parked outside, followed by benches. She had heard Father Flood before Mass asking some women to lend him tablecloths that they could then retrieve when Christmas was over. After his sermon, he had asked for donations of cutlery and glasses and cups and saucers and plates to add to his store. He also made clear that the parish hall would be open from 11 in the morning until 9 in the evening on Christmas Day, and anyone passing, irrespective of creed or country of origin, would be welcome in God's name. Even those not in need of food or refreshment could drop by at any time to add to the day's cheer. But not, he added, between 12:30 and 3, please, when Christmas dinner would be served. He also announced that, beginning in the middle of January, he was going to run a dance in the parish hall every Friday night with a live band, but no alcohol, to raise funds for the parish, and he would like everyone to spread the word. As soon as Eilish had pushed past the men setting the tables and benches down evenly in rows, and women hanging Christmas decorations from the ceiling, she saw Father Flood.
"I wonder would you count the silverware to make sure we have enough," he said. "Otherwise we'll have to go out into the highways and byways."
"How many are you expecting?"
200 last year. They cross the bridges, some of them come down from Queens and in from Long Island.
"And are they all Irish?"
"Yes. They are all leftover Irishmen. They built the tunnels and the bridges and the highways. Some of them I only see once a year. God knows what they live on."
"Why don't they go back home?"
"Some of them are here 50 years, and they've lost touch with everyone," Father Flood said. "One year I got home addresses for some of them, the ones I thought needed help most, and I wrote to Ireland for them. Mostly I got silence, but for one poor old divil, I got a stinker of a letter from his sister-in-law saying that the farm, or the homestead, or whatever it was, wasn't his, and he wasn't to think of ever setting foot in it. She'd scatter him at the gate. I remember that. That's what she said."
Eilish went to midnight Mass with Mrs. Kehoe and Miss Keegan, discovering on the way home that Mrs. Kehoe was among the parishioners who were roasting a turkey and potatoes and boiling a ham for Father Flood, who had arranged for it all to be collected at 12.
"It's like the war," Mrs. Kehoe said. "Feeding the army has to be done like clockwork. I'll carve what our own small needs will be from the turkey, the biggest one I could get. It'll be 6 hours in the oven before I send it off. And we'll eat, just the four of us, myself, Miss McAdam, Miss Heffernan, and Miss Keegan here, as soon as the turkey is off our hands. And if there's anything left over, we'll save it for you, Eilish."
By 9 o'clock, Eilish was in the parish hall peeling vegetables in the big kitchen at the back. There were women working beside her whom she had never met before, all of them older than she, some with faint American accents, but all of Irish origin. Most of them were just here for this part of the morning, she was told, before going home to feed their families. Soon it became clear that two women were in charge. When Father Flood arrived, he introduced Eilish to them.
"They are the Miss Murphys from Arklow," he said, "though we won't hold that against them."
The two Miss Murphys laughed. They were tall, cheerful-looking women in their 50s.
It'll just be the three of us, one of them said, here all day. The other helpers will come and go.
We're the ones with no homes to go to, the other Miss Murphy said and smiled.
Now we'll feed them in sets of 20, her sister said. Each of us prepares 65 dinners, it might even be more, in 3 sittings. I'm in Father Flood's own kitchen, and the two of you are here in the hall. As soon as a turkey arrives, or when the ones we have cooking upstairs are ready, Father Flood will attack them and the hams and carve them. The oven here is just for keeping things hot. For an hour, people will bring us turkeys and hams and roast potatoes, and the thing is to have vegetables cooked and hot and ready to be served.
Rough and ready might be a better way of putting it, the other Miss Murphy interrupted.
But we have plenty of soup and stout for them while they're waiting. They're very nice, all of them.
They don't mind waiting, and if they do,
they don't say.
Are they all men?
Eilish asked.
A few couples come because she is too old to cook, or they're too lonely, or whatever, but the rest are men,
Miss Murphy said.
And they love the company, and it's Irish food, you know, proper stuffing and roast potatoes and Brussels sprouts boiled to death.
She smiled at Eilish and shook her head and sighed. As soon as 10 o'clock Mass was over, people began to call by. Father Flood had filled one of the tables with glasses and bottles of lemonade and sweets for the children. He made everyone who came in, including women with fresh hairdos, put on a paper hat. Thus, as the men began to arrive to spend all of Christmas Day in the hall, they were barely noticed among the crowd. It was only later, after midday, when the visitors began to disperse, that they could be seen clearly, some of them sitting alone with a bottle of stout in front of them, others huddled in groups, many of them stubbornly still wearing cloth caps instead of paper hats. The Miss Murphys were anxious for the men who came first to gather at one or two of the long tables, enough to make a group who could be served soon with bowls of soup so that the bowls could be washed and used again by the next group. As Eilish, on instructions, went out to encourage the men to sit down at the top table nearest to the kitchen, she observed coming into the hall a tall man with a slight stoop. He was wearing a cap low over his forehead and an old brown overcoat with a scarf at the neck. She paused for a moment and stared at him. He stood still as soon as he had closed the main door behind him, and it was the way he took in the hall, surveying the scene with shyness and a sort of mild delight that made Isla sure, for one moment, that her father had come into her presence. She felt as though she should move towards him as she saw him hesitatingly opening his overcoat and loosening his scarf. It was how he stood, taking full, slow possession of the room, searching almost shyly for the place where he might be most comfortable and at ease, or looking around carefully to see if he knew anybody. As she realized that it could not be him, that she was dreaming, he took off his cap and she saw that the man did not look like her father at all. She glanced around her, embarrassed, hoping that no one had noticed her. It was something, she thought, that she could tell no one, that she had imagined for an instant that she had seen her father, who was, she remembered quickly, dead for 4 years. Although the first table had not been filled, she turned and went back to the kitchen and set about checking the number of plates for the first serving, even though she knew she had the right number, and then lifting the lid of the huge saucepan to check if the Brussels sprouts were boiling, even though she knew that the water was not hot enough yet. When one of the Miss Murphys asked her if the nearest table had been filled up, and if every man had a glass of stout, Eilish turned and said that she had done her best to move the men to the tables, but maybe Miss Murphy could do better. She tried to smile, hoping that Miss Murphy did not notice anything strange. For the next 2 hours she was busy, piling food onto plates, carrying them out 2 at a time. Father Flood carved turkeys and hams as they arrived, piling stuffing and roast potatoes into bowls. For a while, one Miss Murphy devoted herself entirely to washing up and drying and cleaning and clearing space as her sister and Eilish served the men, making sure to leave nothing out, turkey, ham, stuffing, roast potatoes, and Brussels sprouts, and making sure in their haste not to give anyone too much or too little. "There's plenty of food now, so don't worry," Father Flood shouted, "but no more than 3 potatoes a head, and go easy on the stuffing." When they had enough meat carved, he went outside and busied himself opening more bottles of stout. At first the men seemed shabby to Eilish, and she noticed body odors from a good number of them.
As they sat down and drank their stout, waiting for the soup or the food, she could not believe there were so many of them, some of them so poor-looking and so old, but even the younger ones had bad teeth and appeared worn down. Many were still smoking, even as the soup came. She did her best to be polite to them. She observed a change in them soon, however, as they began to talk to each other, or shout greetings down the table, or enter into low, intense conversations. At first they had reminded her of men who sat on the bridge in Enniscorthy, or gathered at the seat at Arnold's Cross, or the Louse Bank by the Slaney, or men from the county home, or men from the town who drank too much. But by the time she served them, and they turned to thank her, they seemed more like her father and his brothers in the way they spoke or smiled, the toughness in their faces softened by shyness, what had appeared stubborn or hard now strangely tender. As she served the man she had thought was her father, she looked at him carefully, amazed at how little he actually resembled him, as though it had been a trick of the light or something she had completely imagined. She was surprised also to find that he was talking to the man beside him in Irish. "This was the miracle of the turkey and the ham," Miss Murphy said to Father Flood when large plates of second helpings had been left on all the tables.
"Brooklyn style," her sister said. "I'm glad it's trifle now," she added, "and not plum puddin', and we don't have to worry about keeping it hot."
"Wouldn't you think they'd take off their caps when they are eating?" her sister asked. "Don't they know they're in America?"
"We have no rules here," Father Flood said, "and they can smoke and drink all they like. If we can get them all home safely, that's the main thing. We always have a few a bit too under the weather to go home."
"Too drunk," one Miss Murphy said.
"Ah, on Christmas Day we call it under the weather, and I have a rake of beds made up for them in my own house," Father Flood said. "What we'll do now is have our own dinner," Miss Murphy said, "and I'll set the table, and I've kept a nice dinner for each of us, hot and everything."
"Well, I was wondering if we were going to eat at all," Eilish said.
"Poor Eilish, she's starving, will you look at her?"
"Should we not serve the trifle first?" Eilish asked.
"No, we'll wait," Father Flood said. "It'll stretch the day out."
By the time they were removing the trifle dishes, the hall was a mass of smoke and animated talk. Men sat in groups, with one or two standing behind them. Others moved from group to group, some with bottles of whiskey and brown paper bags that they passed around. When all the cleaning of the kitchen and the filling of garbage cans had been completed, Father Flood suggested that they go into the hall and join the men for a drink. Some visitors had arrived, including a few women, and, Eilish thought, as she sat down with a glass of sherry in her hand, that it could have been a parish hall anywhere in Ireland on the night of a concert or a wedding, when the young people were all elsewhere dancing or standing at the bar. After a while, Eilish noticed that two men had taken out fiddles and another a small accordion. They had found a corner and were playing as a few others stood around and listened. Father Flood was moving about the hall with a notebook now, writing down names and addresses and nodding as old men spoke to him. After a while, he clapped his hands and called for silence, but it took a few minutes before he could get everyone's attention.
"I don't want to interrupt the proceedings," he said, "but we'd like to thank a nice girl from Enniscorthy and two nice women from Arklow for their hard day's work."
There was a round of applause.
"And, as a way of thanking them, there's one great singer in this hall, and we're delighted to see him this year again."
He pointed to the man whom Eilish had mistaken for her father. He was sitting away from Eilish and Father Flood, but he stood up when his name was called and walked quietly towards them. He stood with his back to the wall so that everyone could see him.
"That man," Miss Murphy whispered to Eilish, "has made LPs."
When Eilish looked up, the man was signaling to her. He wanted her, it seemed, to come and stand with him. It struck her for a second that he might want her to sing, so she shook her head, but he kept beckoning, and people began to turn and look at her. She felt that she had no choice but to leave her seat and approach him. She could not think why he wanted her. As she came close, she saw how bad his teeth were. He did not greet her or acknowledge her arrival, but closed his eyes and reached his hand towards hers and held it. The skin on the palm of his hand was soft. He gripped her hand tightly and began to move it in a faint circular motion as he started to sing. His voice was loud and strong and nasal. The Irish he sang in, she thought, must be Connemara Irish, because she remembered one teacher from Galway in the Mercy Convent who had that accent. He pronounced each word carefully and slowly, building up a wildness, a ferocity in the way he treated the melody. It was only when he came to the chorus, however, that she understood the words. Mavyun tulum, astarin makrin. And he glanced at her proudly, almost possessively, as he sang these lines. All the people in the hall watched him silently. There were 5 or 6 verses. He sang the words out with pure innocence and charm, so that at times, when he closed his eyes, leaning his large frame against the wall, he did not seem like an old man at all. The strength of his voice and the confidence of his performance had taken over. And then each time he came to the chorus, he looked at her, letting the melody become sweeter by slowing down the pace, putting his head down then, managing to suggest even more that he had not merely learned the song, but that he meant it. Eilish knew how sorry this man was going to be, and how sorry she would be when the song had ended, when the last chorus had to be sung and the singer would have to bow to the crowd and go back to his place and give way to another singer as Eilish, too, went back and sat in her chair. As the night wore on, some of the men fell asleep or had to be helped to the toilet. The 2 Miss Murphys made pots of tea, and there was Christmas cake. Once the singing ended, some of the men found their coats and came up to thank Father Flood and the Miss Murphys and Eilish, wishing them a happy Christmas before setting out into the night. When most of the men had left, and several who remained seemed to be very drunk, Father Flood told Eilish that she could go if she wanted, and he would ask the Miss Murphys to accompany her to Mrs. Kehoe's house. Eilish said no, she was used to walking home alone, and it would, in any case, she said, be a quiet night. She shook hands with the 2 Miss Murphys and with Father Flood, and wished each of them a happy Christmas, before she set out to walk through the dark, empty streets of Brooklyn. She would, she thought, go straight to her room and avoid the kitchen. She wanted to lie on the bed and go over everything that had happened before falling asleep. Part 3. In January, Eilish felt the fierce, sharp cold in the mornings as she went to work. No matter how fast she walked, and even when she bought thick socks, her feet felt frozen by the time she arrived at Bartocci's. Everyone in the streets was covered up as though afraid to show themselves, wearing thick coats, scarves, hats, gloves, and boots. She noticed that they even covered their mouths and noses with thick scarves or mufflers as they moved along. All she could see was their eyes, and the expression seemed alarmed by the cold, made desperate by the wind and the freezing temperatures. At the end of the lectures in the evening, the students huddled in the hallway of the college, putting on layer after layer of clothes as a defense against the cold night. It was, she thought, like a preparation for a strange play, with all of them trying on costumes, their gestures slow and deliberate, looks of blank determination on their faces. It appeared impossible to imagine a time when it was not cold, and she could walk these streets thinking about something other than the warm hallway of Mrs. Kehoe's house, the warm kitchen, and her own warm bedroom. One evening, as she was about to go upstairs to bed, Eilish saw Mrs. Kehoe standing in the doorway of her own sitting room, hovering there in the shadows as though afraid to be seen. She beckoned to Eilish without speaking, motioning her into the room, and then quietly closed the door. Even as she crossed the room and sat in the armchair by the fire, indicating to Eilish that she should sit in the armchair opposite, she said nothing. The look on her face was grave as she put her right hand out and lowered it, suggesting to Eilish that if she were to speak, her voice should not be loud. "Now," she said, and looked into the fire, which was burning brightly in the grate, before placing a log and then another on the flames. "Not a word that you ever even came in here. Promise?" Eilish nodded. "The truth is that Miss Keegan is departing, and the sooner the better as far as I'm concerned. I have her sworn not to say a word to anyone. She's very west of Ireland, and they're better at saying nothing than we are. So it suits her, because she doesn't have to say any farewells. She'll be gone on Monday, and I want you to move into her room in the basement. It's not damp now, so don't look at me like that.
I'm not looking at you, Eilish said.
Well, don't.
Mrs. Kehoe studied the fire for a moment and then the floor.
It's the best room in the house. The biggest, the warmest, the quietest, and the best appointed. And I don't want any discussion about it. You're getting it, and that's that. So if you pack your things on Sunday, on Monday, when you're at work, I'll have them moved down, and that'll be the end of it. You'll need a key for down below because you have to use your own entrance, which you share with Miss Montini. But of course, even if you lose your key, there's still the stairs between the basement and this floor, so don't look so worried. Will the others not mind that I'm getting the room? Eilish asked.
They will, Mrs. Kehoe said and smiled at her. Then she looked into the fire, nodding her head in satisfaction. She raised her head and gazed bravely at Eilish. It took Eilish a moment to realize that this was a signal from Mrs. Kehoe that she should leave. She stood up quietly as Mrs. Kehoe once more stretched out her right hand to make clear that Eilish should not make a sound. It struck Eilish, as she made her way up the stairs to her bedroom, that the basement room could, in fact, be damp and small. She had never heard anyone say before that it was the best room in the house. She wondered if all this secrecy was not merely a way of landing her there without giving her a chance to see where she was going or make any protest. She would have to wait, she realized, until she came back from her classes on Monday night. Over the next few days, she began to dread the move and resent the idea of Mrs. Kehoe moving her cases when she was out of the house and putting them into a place from which Miss Keegan emerged daily in a state that did not seem to Eilish to suggest that she had the best room in the house. She realized also that she could not appeal to Father Flood, were the room dingy or dark or damp. She had used up enough of his sympathy, and she knew that Mrs. Kehoe was fully aware of this. On the Sunday, as she packed her cases and left them by the bed, finding that she had acquired more belongings than she could fit into them, and having to go downstairs and quietly ask Mrs. Kehoe for some carrier bags, she felt that Mrs. Kehoe had taken advantage of her, and she found herself suffering the beginnings of the terrible homesickness she had gone through before.